Welcome. You're listening to the Malcontent News Russia-Ukraine War Podcast, the show that cuts through the fog of war and updates you about the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts.
Hello, I'm Marina Yevshan, your host of the Russia-Ukraine War Report Podcast, and today is April the 18th, 2024. It has been 3,734 days since Russia started covert military operations in Crimea, 10 years and 58 days since the start of the Russia-Ukraine war, and 2 years and 55 days since Russia expanded its war of aggression. Today's podcast looks at events that happened from Tuesday to Thursday. I appreciate your patience during our unexpected break. During the podcast, you will find the Russia-Ukraine war map helpful to visualize the areas discussed. A link is in the podcast description. There are map updates today. The Russia-Ukraine War Report is compiled by our team from around the world. Today's report includes information from our direct contacts and journalists in Ukraine, the Russian Ministry of Defense, the General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine Morning Reports, Operational Commands North, South and East of Ukraine, Open Source Intelligence, our in-house team of analysts and geospatial experts, and pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian male bloggers and social media channels with a track record of trying to be accurate. We have one mission, the truth, because the truth matters. Here is my daily assessment. 1. Ukrainian forces have insufficient ammunition resources to hold existing defensive lines and protect the civilian population, and without immediate assistance will be forced to withdraw on multiple axes. 2. In our assessment, it is highly likely that the United States government will restart military aid to Ukraine by April the 30th, after an April the 16th classified briefing to the House Intelligence Committee outlined the dire situation in Ukraine and the impact a Russian victory will have on global security. 3. Based on multiple reports that the United States has set multiple restrictions on what military equipment can be provided and how it can be used due to a misguided fear of a Russian tactical nuclear strike, the world is caught in the mutually assured destruction and stability paradox. 4. Russian forces have an operational goal to capture Chasiv Yar by May the 9th, regardless of cost. 5. Russia is also setting conditions in two additional operational areas for future wider attacks, but we continue to question how much combat potential will be available to expand current operations this summer. 6. Russia's trampling of international humanitarian law has been accelerating since March the 22nd. In our assessment, the willful ignoring of blatant Russian war crimes by international watchdogs will continue to encourage escalation. 7. The disjointed response to Russian aggression by Ukraine's allies continues to embolden Moscow, leading to the most serious airspace violation of a NATO country since Russia expanded its war of aggression on February 24, 2022. Inaction by the United States and the excessively risk-averse rules of engagement forced on the NATO alliance are creating an environment ripe for a serious international incident. 8. The attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure have incrementally increased the chance of an intentional nuclear accident at multiple nuclear facilities in Ukraine. And the situation is more serious, especially at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, than what the International Atomic Energy Agency is reporting. We're changing the format of the podcast because Russian attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure have become so frequent. Instead of reporting on them by areas of operation or AOs, I'll be combining them into a single section. Our team has also combined Zaporizhzhia and Kherson oblasts into a single AO due to the continued limited activity in both areas. Starting with Russian attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure. On Wednesday morning, three Russian Iskander-M short-range ballistic missiles struck the center of Chernihiv. Missiles hit the Prospilkovy Hotel, apartment blocks, the Chernihiv Central Hospital, the Chernihiv National University of Technology, and nearby homes, and flung shrapnel through a park and onto downtown streets. Video recorded in a reproductive health clinic captured the moments of the second and third missile strikes, and at the nearby hospital, officials reported there were 30 patients under care at the time of the attack. The World Health Organization reported 3 healthcare workers were wounded in the missile strike and called, quote, for all efforts to be made to protect healthcare. The attack killed 18 and wounded 78, including 4 children, with 37 in hospital. Among the dead was Alina Mykolaitis, a 25-year-old police officer. She had taken a sick day and was on her way to the hospital when her car was sprayed with shrapnel. During Wednesday's United Nations press briefing, Stéphane Dujarric, the spokesman for the Security General, said, quote, the humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine, Denise Brown, today condemned the latest wave of deadly strikes across the country, including in the northern city of Chernihiv. Ms. Brown underscored that under international humanitarian law, civilians and hospitals must be protected at all times, unquote. Chernihiv was almost surrounded in March 2022, with Russian forces withdrawing from the city after their defeat at Kyiv. The last major attack was in August 2023. On April the 15th, the VKS, that's the Russian Aerospace Forces, bombed the farming village of Lukyantsi, northeast of Kharkiv, killing 2 pensioners and wounding 4. All of the victims were civilians. 2 days later, the VKS bombed Borova, causing additional damage to the already abandoned village administrative building. The airstrike also damaged the courthouse, library, and private homes. 2 more civilians were wounded in Zolochiv after a Fab 500 UMPK glide bomb struck the village. The mayor of Kharkiv, Igor Terekhov, told the British newspaper The Guardian that without military help from the United States and modern air defense, his city could become the, quote, second Aleppo. In 2016, Aleppo, a city in Syria, was bombed for months by the VKS, destroying 95% of the buildings and all infrastructure. The spokesperson for the main Defense Intelligence Directorate for the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine, also known as the HUR, Andriy Yusov, rebuked Terekhov for making the comparison, telling reporters, quote, Ukraine is not Syria. And I would not use apocalyptic scenarios for comparison. It is clear that Ukraine is not alone in this situation, and the Ukrainian Defense Forces also have something to respond with. But at the same time, we critically need international assistance and support. Unquote. In northeastern Donetsk Oblast, Russia shelled the settlement of Siversk with Grad rockets fired by multiple launch rocket systems, also called MLRS, killing 4 civilians. South of Izum, a Russian Kh-36 Grom E-1 tactical air-to-surface cruise missile struck the center of Slovyansk, causing significant damage to an apartment building. There were no injuries reported. On Wednesday, Russian shelling of Free Kherson Oblast targeted multiple villages and the cities of Bereslav and Kherson, wounding 16 civilians. To the southwest, unspecified infrastructure facilities were hit near Odessa by a Russian missile. There was no other information available about casualties or damage. Russia shelled the Nikopol Rayon in Dnipropetrovsk Oblast from fire bases near the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, wounding a pensioner and damaging private homes, a gym, and power lines. Finally, during the evening of April the 16th and the 17th, Bilopilje in the Sumy Oblast was hit by Grad rockets fired by MLRS, damaging apartment buildings, houses, and a gas pipeline. 1 civilian was injured. Moving to the action report, we start in Kharkiv and Luhansk Oblasts. In the Kupinskoye, the Russian Ministry of Defense, also called RMOD, reported fighting in the area of Sinkivka. Further south, near Svatovo in Luhansk Oblast, 4 squad-sized Russian sabotage and reconnaissance units were neutralized east of the Kharkiv Oblast village of Novosergiivka. After a lull in fighting, Russian forces increased their activity in the Kremennaye of Luhansk Oblast. Russian forces attempted to advance on Nevsky, suffered losses, and retreated. Russian forces continued their efforts to advance on Terny without success. Armut claimed Ukrainian forces launched counterattacks near Torske and Dibrova without evidence. In the Siversky-Yo of Luhansk Oblast, Russian forces continued their attempts to advance in the direction of the chalk mine Terekon southeast of Bilohorivka after being pushed back earlier in the week. A geolocated video showed Russia lost a company of mechanized armor, including 40 ATBV main battle tanks and 6 armored vehicles, in a failed attack in the direction of Verkhnyokamenskoye from Zolotarivka at the Luhansk-Donetsk Oblast's administrative border. We link to the video in our daily situation report, along with many other videos, pictures, and quotes. You can learn more in the podcast description or by searching for Malcontent News on patreon.com. Moving to the Donbas, in northeastern Donetsk Oblast, Russian forces expanded their attacks. In the Siversky-Yo of Donetsk Oblast, Russian troops continued their attempts to advance into the center of Spirne and the direction of Vyimka without success. Further south, in the Soledar-Yo, Russian forces continued to probe Ukrainian defenses, making another attempt to advance in the direction of Rozdolivka. In the Kostyantynivka-Yo, Russian forces continued to advance on Chasiv Yar in 3 directions. Armud reported fighting, quote, in the area of Bohdanivka, likely referencing the village of Kalinivka. A video geolocated by our analysts showed that Russian troops had advanced south of the village and almost reached the Siversky-Donets-Donbas canal between the railroad bridge and the Koshovoho Street bridge that leads into the Novye micro-district in Chasiv Yar. Our analysts were alarmed to see Russian troops advancing this quickly. Russian forces have likely reached the first homes within Chasiv Yar, but the earlier airstrikes by the VKS are complicating their ability to hold their new positions. While fighting has never stopped in Ivanivske, Russia is making a new effort to bypass Ukrainian defenses from the south and advance in the direction of Stupochka. Ukrainian forces are outmatched 10-1 in artillery and have no short-range air defense capabilities. First-person view one-way drones are not an adequate substitute for the lack of mortars, artillery, and anti-tank weapons. In our assessment, without immediate aid, the situation could deteriorate very quickly. Further south, positional fighting continued northwest, north and east of Krishivka and southeast of Andriivka. Finally, in the Turetsk-New York-Yo, Armud reported fighting in the area of Shumy and Pivdenne, near the edges of Horlivka. In southwest Donetsk Oblast, Russian forces are exhausting Ukraine's active defense strategy by exploiting weaknesses found in their defensive lines and making additional tactically significant gains. In the Avdiivka-Yo, north and northwest of Krasnohorivka, the situation has deteriorated. Russian troops advanced to the southeastern edge of Novokolonovo and occupied several buildings. Using the railroad grade, Russian forces bypassed Novobakhmutivka and advanced into the southeastern tip of Ocheretene, where fighting was ongoing. Ukrainian forces were able to make a small advance in Berdychi, pushing Russian forces back into the ruins of the village. A very graphic video showed a Russian soldier walking to his forwardmost line of friendly troops with the torn bodies of his comrades scattered across the road. Fighting for control of Semenivka continued after a new geolocated video showed that Russian troops had moved north on the T-542 highway. Based on multiple Russian reports of ongoing fighting, we continue to code the village as contested. Heavy fighting continued east of Umanske and near Netailove. To the south, Russian and Ukrainian sources reported that fighting continued in Pervomayske. In the Vuhledar-Yo, intense fighting continued on the southeastern and southern edges of Krasnohorivka. Russian forces used another total tank equipped with an electronic warfare system to enter the settlement. Russian forces were also able to advance following their railroad tracks to the train station, but were unable to hold their gains due to a lack of defensible positions. To the south, Russian forces renewed their attempts to advance from Pobeda without success. Fighting continued in Novomikhailivka, where Ukrainian forces were able to take back some lost positions. Russian troops made another push from Solotke in the direction of Vodene, suffered losses, and retreated to their defensive positions. Russian forces continued their subordinate attacks in the Staromlinivka AO, continuing their attacks west of Staromayorske with no change in the situation. Earlier in the week, Russian forces attempted to advance north of Priyutne on the Donetsk-Zaporizhia Oblast's administrative border, suffered losses, and retreated to their defensive positions. In Zaporizhia and Kherson oblasts, fighting intensity remained low. Russian assaults continued in the Orikhiv AO, with an attempt to advance north of Novopokrovka into Bilohiria, which ended in failure. Russian troops also attempted to advance northwest of Verbove without success. Sporadic fighting continued south of Robotyne in a wide gray zone from near the post office to the southern edge of Novoprokopivka. A video recorded by a drone showed that Russian artillery and airstrikes had completely destroyed Robotyne. On April 15, in occupied Berdyansk, Russian occupiers claimed they shot down two Storm Shadow cruise missiles, while local insurgents reported a hit on a Russian command post. On April 17, Russian propagandist Rybar confirmed the strike, but claimed it was unsuccessful. In the Kherson AO, Russian forces continued their attempts to push Ukrainian forces out of Krynki without success. Here is what's happening in the Black Sea, occupied Crimea, Mykolaiv and Odessa. Starting in occupied Crimea, the military airfield southeast of Jankoy was hit by at least two ATACMS missiles. A geolocated video showed a massive explosion with multiple large missiles cooking off, and NASA Fire Information for Resource Management Systems, or FIRMS, showed there were multiple secondary fires. We link to the video showing the explosions in our situation report. There's more information in the podcast description. An entire S-400 air defense battery appears to have been destroyed, including visual confirmation of three S-400 launchers lost. The Crimean Tatar insurgent organization ATESH reported that a radar for the S-400, two S-300 launchers, and additional air defense missile ammunition stored in the northeast corner of the airfield were also destroyed. Russian sources reported that between 15 to 30 Russian troops were killed, up to 22 were missing, and up to 80 were wounded. We could not independently verify the claims. ATESH reported that, quote, caravans of ambulances were traveling to occupied Sevastopol to the military hospital of the Russian Black Sea Fleet and the First City Hospital. In Odessa, Ukrainian officials reported a Shahed 136 one-way drone struck an infrastructure facility, with a picture showing evidence of a large fire. There was no information on damage or casualties. It was very busy on the Russian front. In Belgorod, air defenses were active, with numerous explosions reported. Russia repeated its claim that the attack was 122mm Grad rockets fired by Czech-provided RM-70 MLRS. There are no known 122mm rockets that have a range in excess of 40 km. On April 16, the Security Service of Ukraine, or SBU, led a mission that destroyed a Russian 1L119 Nebo-U air defense radar using one-way drones. The Nebo-U has a range of up to 700 km and helped provide early warning to Russia for Ukrainian drone launches. In the Mordovia Republic, not to be confused with Morda, at least one Ukrainian drone struck the Russian over-the-horizon 29B6 radar near Kavilkina. The radar system is part of Russia's early warning defense system to detect and track ICBM launches as part of their nuclear deterrent, a so-called Moscow Red Line. Wait, let me look out my window. Nope. Nothing has changed. The same burnt ruins of what used to be our neighbors' houses left by Russians in 2022, but nuclear war hasn't started. I didn't get my Voltec notification, and no signs of gulification. It's almost like the red lines are imaginary. Ukrainian Special Operation Forces released a video showing the destruction of a Russian Mi-8 helicopter at the Kryaz military airfield near Samara. Not to be outdone by the SBU or SSO, the Hur attacked the Tupolev-Gorbunovo plant in Kazan, Russia, with one-way drones. The factory services two 22 M3 and two 160 strategic bombers and is potentially a drone assembly site. At the time of publication, the amount of damage was unknown. Russia claimed it used electronic warfare to down a Ukrainian drone near Voronezh, which was strategically guided right into a warehouse with lumber and machine tools.
You're listening to the Malcontent News Russia-Ukraine War Podcast. Our team of journalists, researchers, and analysts is funded by readers, listeners, and viewers just like you. To support independent journalism, please consider becoming a patron. You can find us on patreon.com at Malcontent News.
Here is my theater-wide update, and a lot happened in the last days. From April the 15th to the morning of April the 18th, Ukrainian air defenses shot down 22 of 23 Shahed 136 one-way drones, a significant reduction from earlier in the month. On Wednesday, insurgents in occupied Crimea reported that two Il-76 heavy airlift transports arrived at Belbek military airfield. These flights commonly carry Shahed drones, and the number of drone strikes will likely intensify. President of Ukraine Volodymyr Zelensky signed the new mobilization law, which will go into effect on May the 18th. There are too many changes to cover in today's podcast, but we include the critical points in our almost daily situation report. At the Khmelnytsky nuclear power plant, construction of two new reactors officially started. Reactors 5 and 6 will use United States technology from Westinghouse. When the project is completed, KNPP will generate as much power as the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant before Russia illegally occupied it. Ukraine has started serial production of its new Ram-X one-way drone, which is similar to the Russian Zala Landsat. The Ukrainian version has a 100-kilometer range and a cruise speed of 180 kilometers per hour. It carries a 3-kilogram warhead that can be swapped to support different missions. AI provides inertial guidance, which will continue to its target independent of the operator once it's acquired. With a fragmentation warhead, it can even be used to target other drones. Ukraine is also increasing the range of the Neptune anti-ship missile to 1,000 kilometers and plans to increase production substantially. In the UAE, Ukraine, working with defense contractor Highland Systems, has developed a 10-person submarine that can fire torpedoes with a speed of up to 50 kilometers per hour. Highland Systems reported that the submarine passed initial testing. Latvia and Ukraine signed a security agreement, with Kyiv now having security guarantees from 10 nations, including the United Kingdom, Germany, France, and Canada. NATO will hold a meeting of the Ukraine NATO Council on April the 19th to discuss deliveries of air defense systems and artillery shells for Ukraine. President Zelensky requested the meeting due to the critical shortages of mortars, artillery rounds, anti-tank weapons, and anti-aircraft munitions. The Federal Minister for Foreign Affairs of Germany, Annalena Baerbock, along with the Minister of Defense Boris Pistorius, said that as part of the immediate action on air defense for Ukraine, they have already reached out to the European Union, NATO alliance members, and third-party nations without success. The Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, proposed to buy Patriot air defense systems from countries who are unwilling to transfer to Ukraine directly, adding, quote, "There is money for this." But here is the big news. There was a seismic shift in Washington, D.C., hours after a late-night classified briefing to the House Intelligence Committee on the situation in Ukraine. After the briefing, Congressman Mike Turner, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and Jim Hines, the ranking member, wrote on Twitter, also known as X, quote, We must pass Ukraine aid now. Today, in a classified briefing, our committee was informed of the critical need to provide Ukraine military aid this week. The United States must stand against Putin's war of aggression now, as Ukraine's situation on the ground is critical. Unquote. The briefing came after the House Armed Services Committee received a similar report. Here is junior member Congressman Jeff Jackson.
One of the biggest remaining legislative dams in Congress just burst, and it is going to be a wild couple of weeks. We've been waiting for months for a bunch of big votes to happen, but the Speaker's been putting them off because the biggest one is Ukraine. The Speaker wants to pass a bill to support Ukraine, but his right flank doesn't. And he knows if he goes around them and passes it anyway, they'll try to fire him. So all year he's been trying to play political chess with this, trying to figure if he moves the Ukraine piece at the same time as another piece, will that let him do this? But none of it really looked like it was going to work, so he hasn't really made any moves, and we've basically had a frozen chessboard all year. Then things became desperate in Ukraine. I'm on the Armed Services Committee, and last week we had our top military leadership tell us that we can either immediately resupply Ukraine with the two things it really needs from us, being artillery shells to keep the Russian army from advancing and air defense interceptors to keep the Russian Air Force largely on the ground, or we can watch as Russia conquers Ukraine.
On Wednesday, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson released four draft bills with military support for Israel, Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific, Ukraine and the United States national security. The Speaker went on the offensive, promoting the drafts. Here is Speaker Johnson talking to the U.S. news agency CNN.
We know what the timetable is. We know the urgency in Ukraine and in Israel. And we are going to stand by Israel, our close ally and dear friend, and we're going to stand for freedom and make sure that Vladimir Putin doesn't march through Europe. These are important responsibilities. A strong America is good for the entire world. Since World War II, really, the responsibility for the free world has been shifted onto our shoulders, and we accept that role. We're an exceptional nation. We're the greatest nation on the planet, and we have to act like it. And we have to project to Putin and Xi and Iran and North Korea and anybody else that we will defend freedom. It doesn't mean boots on the ground. We're not the world's policemen, but we're going to do the right thing.
When asked about a looming motion to vacate if he put the Ukrainian aid bill forward, this is what Johnson had to say to U.S. network C-SPAN.
My philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. Look, history judges us for what we do. This is a critical time right now, a critical time on the world stage. I could make a selfish decision and do something that that's different. But I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel and the briefings that we've gotten that I believe Xi and Vladimir Putin and Iran really are an axis of evil. I think they're in coordination on this. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a live-fire exercise for me, as it is so many American families.
So, what's in the package? $23 billion to replenish U.S. arsenals, $7.85 billion in Presidential Drawdown Authority, or PDA, in addition to the $3.9 billion that remains from the 2023 fiscal year, $13.8 billion to U.S. aid, $1.6 billion in foreign military financing. The $7.85 billion in new PDA would be in the form of a loan. After November 15, 2024, with support from Congress, President Joe Biden can forgive 50%. After January 1, 2026, the sitting president, with the support of Congress, can write off the entire amount. Included in the Republican-created Ukraine aid bill is a provision to transfer the entire inventory of expired ATACMS missiles, approximately 1,200 units, as soon as possible. President Biden can delay the transfer if this threatens U.S. national security, but Congress must be notified and a classified briefing provided on why. The bill also requires that within 45 days of being signed into law, the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense must submit a strategy for the support of Ukraine against aggression by the Russian Federation. There is a lot of additional language, but the most critical requirements include how the plan will accelerate, quote, Ukraine's victory over the Russian invasion forces in a manner most favorable to the interests and objectives of the United States, as well as a description of the consequences for the national security of the United States if these objectives are not achieved, unquote. It also requires that the plan helps, quote, Ukraine end the conflict as a democratic, independent, and sovereign nation capable of deterring and defending its territory from future aggression. A vote on the four packages, including for Ukraine aid, is expected on April the 20th, and the House and Senate have already extended their sessions, which were supposed to end today. President Biden released a statement on Wednesday declaring, quote, I strongly support this package to get critical support to Israel and Ukraine, provide desperately needed humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Gaza, and bolster security and stability in the Indo-Pacific. Ukraine is facing continued bombardment from Russia that has intensified dramatically in the last month. The House must pass the package this week, and the Senate should quickly follow. I will sign this into law immediately to send a message to the world. We stand with our friends, and we won't let Iran or Russia succeed. Unquote. Congressman Thomas Massie has joined Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene in threatening to execute a discharge petition that would remove Johnson, but it seems unlikely it would pass. Greene also introduced an unserious amendment to the Ukraine aid bill, calling for any congressperson who votes in support of it to enlist in the Ukrainian armed forces. She also submitted an amendment to the Israel package demanding that the funds be used to develop, quote, space laser technology to be used on the southwest border of the United States. David, are you okay over there in the United States?
For our audience, this was written into the script. While Marina is recording, the U.S. team is asleep, and this was supposed to be a little segue into a joke where I was going to say, no, we're not okay, and it would go back to Marina. A lot has happened in the 8 or 9 hours since the script was handed off to our team in Ukraine. If you are among our 43% of listeners who live in the United States, you can just put your fingers in your ears at this point and go, la, 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 la. This is really for the 57% outside of the United States to explain our political landscape. While the United States has a two-party system of Democrats, liberals, and Republicans, conservatives, within those parties, there are factions. Essentially, the United States has five parties right now. Starting on the far left, you have what's called the Progressive Caucus. Moving to my opinion, I would argue they're not progressive. They are much further to the left than they advertise themselves. And then the next group is you have Democrats. Then you have this third party, which are independents, people that have abandoned the Democratic Party, that have abandoned the Republican Party, and quite frankly are exhausted by the antics going on both sides. Then you have your Republicans, and you have very few, say, Reagan Republicans left in the party. Most of them have fled or have announced this year that they are quitting. They are leaving politics. And then you have the Freedom Caucus on the far right. And then you have someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I lump in that Freedom Caucus, but who is so far out to the right that even the Freedom Caucus kicked her out. What's happened since Marina recorded the podcast and it came to the United States and we started editing is members of the far-right Freedom Caucus, the ultra-MAGAs, have introduced over 100 amendments to the Ukraine bill and the Israeli bill in an attempt to derail both of them. 12 hours ago, reading that Marjorie Taylor Greene had put an amendment on the Israeli bill calling for the implementation of space lasers was amusing. What's happening now is the amendments are pure Russian propaganda. Some of them are items that the Russian state Duma considered taking up, not in the context of aid to Ukraine, but in other political contexts, that was so out there that the state Duma didn't even put it up for a vote. Which raises a question, and then I move to the line of assessment and opinion. I'm going to blend the two together. The United States is a nation of laws. We have always been a nation of laws, and we have sometimes fumbled and stumbled in being that nation, but it's always come back together. And part of that is we're not a country that prosecutes or arrests our political enemies or political opponents simply because we do not like what those political opponents are saying or proposing. It is something that separates the United States from many other countries on the planet. And you can probably feel the butt is coming. If we look through our history and we go back to the 1850s, there were congresspersons who were actively working against the U.S. government in the lead up to the United States Civil War. If we look at history and go back to 1936, 37, 38, 39, 40, there were congresspersons who were repeating Nazi propaganda verbatim on the floor of Congress. There were 100,000 members of the German-American Bund that gathered in New York City and attended a rally at Madison Square Garden. German-American Bund was just a way of saying Nazi with extra words. This is U.S. history. We've been here before. Now I'm going to move to pure opinion. I'm someone who looks at the United States Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the additional 17 amendments that have been passed since the Bill of Rights was created, and I hold those sacred. I look at those in a pretty pure translation of how the authors of those intended them to be viewed. But here is the national security question. At what point does speech from politicians who are among some of the most powerful people on the planet, let's not forget that. You can be the most junior congressperson in the U.S. Congress, and you hold more power than most people do on planet Earth. So as much as you might want to look at somebody like Thomas Massie or Marjorie Taylor Greene and roll your eyes and go, what is wrong with this person? They hold a lot of power. And that raises that final question. At what point does the line between, well, this is speech from a political opponent and we in the United States don't arrest or use the legal system to go after our political opponents, to this person is a foreign agent actively working against the interests and the national security of the United States of America. And if that line is crossed and we are a nation of laws, then what do we do? Because in my opinion, it has become very apparent in the last 12 hours that there is a active fifth column within the United States Congress. And the question then becomes, is this pre-Civil War? Is this 1930s United States? Or is there something deeper that the intelligence community needs to take a hard look at? So are we okay here in the United States? No, we're not, but thank you for asking.
Moving to assessment. I wish there were more funding, but this sets the foundation for continued support for Ukraine after the US national elections. The requirement to outline a strategy at a tactical, operational, and strategic level on what is exactly required for Ukraine to win has been lacking, at least in the public domain, and something many congressional leaders have asked for. Our team is cautiously optimistic that the bill will pass through the House. I'm still tracking Discharge Petition 9, which continues to need 23 signatures to advance the Senate bill, but hopefully that is now unnecessary. The Prime Minister of the Czech Republic, Petr Fiala, announced the first contract for 180,000 artillery shells for Ukraine has been signed and will be delivered, quote, in the coming months. Contracts are still being negotiated for another 300,000 shells. Moving to more assessment. It appears that Ukraine increased its use of artillery in March in anticipation of promised shipments from the European Union and the Czech-led Ammunition Initiative shells arriving no later than early June. In our assessment, we find it damaging and frustrating that Ukraine's allies consistently miss promised delivery dates, impacting the theater of war. These delays have contributed to the near-catastrophic ammunition shortage that is worsening with each passing day. Fiala went on to say that Prague could deliver up to 1 million artillery rounds in the next 12 months if more financing can be found. The Minister for Foreign Affairs of Norway, Espen Barth Eide, said that Ukraine would receive a significant number of F-16 aircraft, and Norway would provide fully modernized fighters with the latest weapons. Currently, there are commitments to provide 55 planes from at least three countries. Lithuania announced it was allocating $3.3 million for the production of first-person view one-way drones. The Netherlands will provide $220 million in Heidrun RQ-35 drones in collaboration with Denmark and Germany. And Canada announced it is transferring 450 Sky Ranger drones. The Netherlands also announced that over the next 2 years it would provide Ukraine with an additional $4.8 billion in aid. Denmark announced a new military aid package to Ukraine of $310 million for the purchase of drones, production of missile components, and additional assistance in the, quote, maritime sphere. And that's what we know. Your support of my home, Ukraine, helps us make history and protect the future for all.
You've been listening to the Malcontent News Russia-Ukraine War Podcast. To help keep us independent, please consider providing financial support by becoming a patron. Want on-demand news in your hand? Download the Google News app and make Malcontent News one of your favorites to receive breaking news updates. Thank you for listening,